Welcome to Hope for the Caregiver here on American Family Radio. I am Peter Rosenberger. This is the program for you as a family caregiver. How you doing? How you holding up? What's going on with you as you care for your loved one? You know, healthy caregivers make better caregivers. How would you rate your health today? Physical, emotional, spiritual, financial? How are all those things working? If you feel like you're struggling, you're in the right place. Recently, Gracie and I had a lunch with a woman who was really struggling. Her 21-year-old son has now decided he's a woman and wants to live accordingly. And she was wrestling with this issue mightily, as you can imagine. She went on to add that her son had recently gotten mad at her and said, you know, you've got pictures of me as a boy all around the house, and I don't want them there. And I watched her struggle to remind herself to call him she, as she referred to him. And it was very difficult for her. She was stammering through it and trying to find solid ground here. And she said, but he wants me to take all the pictures down of him when he was a boy, because now he wants to identify as a woman. She said, what do I do? Well, first off, I am no trained counselor. I'm no mental health expert. I am a caregiver, and I am somebody who has watched suffering for a very long time. And the only thing I knew were my own experiences and how it relates in the context of the Word of God. But I asked her, I said, well, whose house is it? She said, well, it's my house. And I said, well, it seems that you can mourn the loss of your son however you choose to. She seemed very surprised by the answer and kind of took a deep breath and said, yeah, you're right, I can. Now, I don't know how that situation has resolved itself, and I don't know that it will resolve itself. I think that is a troubling set of circumstances that seem to be gripping a lot of people in our society, and certainly is a hot button issue in our culture. Again, I'm no trained mental health expert. I'm not clergy. I'm not any of those things. But let me throw this out at you and see what you think. You know, most of you that listen to this program regularly know that my wife is a bilateral amputee. Both of her legs below the knee are amputated. This was an extremely difficult choice for her. Her legs were so damaged that it was killing her to keep them. And it was a very painful decision that she spent a good bit of time with on removing those legs. The wreck that she had back in 1983, in a sense, amputated both of them. Surgically, they were repaired, but never able to function normally. And sometimes parts of our body are broken, and they're so broken that they're hurting the body. Well, imagine if you would, if somebody wanted to amputate a fully functional part of their body just because they wanted to scratch an emotional itch or identify as something else. And there are people out there who have done that have had amputation done to their bodies. Some of them I know have sawed their own fingers off so they could identify as an amputee. I know of these. I've met these people. What would you say about them? That's a fully functional, healthy part of their body. Just because they have an emotional itch, they want to do it. Gracie had to have her legs removed because they were broken and damaged. The limb was damaged. It was not functioning. It was creating so much pain for her and so much distress. And after many years of trying to save it, she finally sat down with her surgeon and made the call. And she's gone on to live a much better life with prosthetic limbs than she had with her real limbs. But it was not done to scratch an emotional itch or a mental state of mind. There are people out there now who are advocating that we put chemicals into children's bodies, puberty blockers, because of an emotional plight that the kids may or may not find themselves in. They're advocating that they perform surgery on minors to remove and mutilate healthy, functioning parts of their body, all because of an ideology that is sweeping certain parts of our culture. Gracie's amputations were not done because of an emotional need to identify as something different. Her legs were broken beyond repair. They tried to repair them. It was prohibiting her from being able to function. Her gallbladder burst. They had to remove that. If somebody came to the surgeon and said, take out my gallbladder, I can live without it. Take it out. Well, is there something wrong with it? Well, no, I just don't want to have it. I just like to identify somebody without a gallbladder. You see the correlation? You see what's going on? In the Hippocratic Oath, it says, I will do no harm or injustice to them, meaning my patients. Neither will I administer a poison to anybody when asked to do so, nor will I suggest such a course. Similarly, I will not give to a woman a pessary to cause an abortion, but I will keep pure and holy both my life and my art. I will not use the knife, not even, verily, on sufferers from stone, meaning kidney stones. In other words, the knife is the last thing, the last course of action. And yet we have people rushing now to mutilate minors. We have people rushing to do things that are just horrific. The Hippocratic Oath goes on to say, in whatsoever houses I enter, I will enter to help the sick, and I will abstain from all intentional wrongdoing and harm, especially from abusing the bodies of man or woman, bond or free. And it goes on at the end of it. He says, now if I carry out this oath and break it not, may I gain forever reputation among all men for my life and for my art. But if I break it and forswear myself, may the opposite befall me. Now that's the Hippocratic Oath that has stood for eons. And yet now, look at where we are as a society. We're having these conversations. Why? Again, I'm going to ask you, if somebody came to you and said, I want to amputate my left hand so that I can identify as a right-handed person. Is there something wrong with your left hand? No, I don't like it. I don't like the way it makes me feel. Well, then let's go see a surgeon right away. This is, in a sense, what is happening. And so I ask you, what are we to do about this? Do we just go along with this woke culture? Do we just go ahead and say, well, sure, whatever, go ahead. Here's a surgeon down the road down there. Go down and do that. Or do we recognize that there is a greater issue going on and we address it accordingly with the Word of God? Romans 12:2. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that by testing you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. And I ask you, does this sound like the will of God? Does this in any way coincide with Scripture? This move to mutilate minors and children, not to mention adults, but adults are adults, but they're doing it to children. And they're putting this pressure on us that we must accept this. And it's tearing families apart. It's tearing churches apart. What are we to do about this? If you even cursory glance at the news, you'll see that there is this move to normalize mental illness in our society. And there are a lot of family members who are stuck in this, caregivers of the mentally ill. And we're going to talk about that some more when we come back. This is Peter Rosenberg. This is Hope for the Caregiver. We'll be right back.
There is a Redeemer, Jesus. Jesus, God's own Son, precious Lamb of God, Messiah, Holy One.
Welcome back to Hope for the Caregiver here on American Family Radio. That is Keith Green, and I love that hymn. I love playing that hymn. Every time I sit down to the piano and play that, I just love it. It's one of those 25 hymns I think every Christian ought to know. It's an extraordinary hymn, so if you don't know it, please take time to go out and search it and learn it. We play it quite often on this program, probably need to play it more. The message of that hymn, to me, helps me keep a 30,000-foot view, even higher, of the bigger picture, that there is a Redeemer. And all the things that we look at as caregivers are in the context of that great Redeemer who is working through all of this. It helps give me that assurance so that I can walk through the things that God has invited Gracie and I to walk through and trust Him with greater understanding. And so that's why I love that hymn. Many years ago, I mean, this has got to be, wow, well over 30 years ago. Before Gracie gave up her legs, it was the right leg first. Both of her legs were basically mangled in the car wreck, and they surgically rebuilt them to the best they could. But the right one, particularly the right ankle, was so messed up, and she was hobbling around with a cane. She was 20, maybe 25, 24. It was a very difficult time for her. Her right foot was kind of pointed inward. She had a very noticeable limp and walking gait that was very impaired. And they had fused this ankle several times to no avail. It was just continuing to decline. Most of the challenges that Gracie has today are as a result of so many surgeries trying to save her legs. This right leg was the main culprit. She went through a lot of heartache to save that right leg and ultimately had to give it up. But she was still struggling in that manner on that leg at this time, and there was a pastor at a church we attended there in Nashville. He was new there, and he saw her coming out. Now, you got to see the picture with Gracie. I mean, Gracie, go back. Don't take my word for it. Google her. I mean, she's just an exquisitely beautiful woman. And here's this young woman, just so beautiful. And she just dressed impeccably, just an extraordinarily beautiful woman. She's coming out of church, and she's got this cane. It was a cane that her father made for her out of cedar from out here in this place in Montana. And she leaned on that cane, and she was walking on it. And here she was walking. And again, she wasn't even 25. And this pastor, who had never met her, looked at her and he said, if you ever get tired of using that, I've had some great experiences and gifting from the Lord on healing. Well, both of us were a bit taken aback. How did he respond? We were both just, kids in our 20s, and we've been struggling with this. And I don't remember how we got out of the conversation. But it stayed with me. I can remember where we were. We said it's one of those flashbulb moments in my mind. And I called him up later on that evening, and he didn't know us that at all. And I said, I would love to talk with you more about this. Do you know the history of how we got here? And he didn't know really anything about it. And I kind of gave him a big picture. And he said he'd like to come over to the house. And the next night or so, I think it was within 48 hours, he showed up. I heard the doorbell ring in our home. And he stood outside. He said, I can't come in here until I ask for your forgiveness. He was almost at the point of tears. We welcomed him into the house, and he sat down with us, and he just apologized profusely for his insensitivity. At some point between my phone call and him showing up at the house, something changed. And he was incredibly gracious and extremely sorrowful that he had overstepped and been so glib about it. I don't doubt that he had witnessed amazing healing events in his past, and he continued to pray for us regularly and stayed with Gracie and I through some very hard realities. And I love him deeply to this day. It was just one of those kind of extraordinary moments. And we didn't talk a lot about faith healing and things such as that afterwards, even though neither of us, Gracie included, discounted that God could. I think there was just that general awareness that in this particular case, God chose not to. And we accepted and trusted him in it. It was an extraordinary moment, though, to see him standing out on our doorstep like that. I cannot come into your home until I ask for your forgiveness. And I thought, how many of us wade into people's suffering with little or no understanding of how they got there, including things such as mental illness, including things with this gender issue that's affecting so many and is on the airwaves, everything else. How did we get here? What's the backstory? Do we just, you know, walk in ham-fisted like a, you know, or like a bunch of Clydesdale into people's heartache? Or can we step into it boldly, but with great compassion? I have some friends of mine who adopted a baby, and this child has been through quite a bit. As she matured and got older, she went through all kinds of stuff. And they did some work. They didn't know. She came into this world with so many things stacked against her, and they didn't know all the things that had gone on with her biological parents, you know, drugs, addiction, other things. And there was not that understanding of what this would mean to this child as it grew up. Some things get passed on from generation to generation. And as this child was acting out and going through all this stuff, and these two people are the most loving, wonderful people you would ever hope to meet. And their heartache just grew and grew and grew and still persists to this day. And all too many Christians wanted to parachute in and tell them what they ought to do, tell them how to do this and this and so forth. You know, think about the reaction you felt when I described that pastor telling Gracie, well, if you ever get tired of using that cane, I've got some real healing gifts. I mean, think about how aghast you felt to hear that, because you've as an audience member, you've gotten to know Gracie, and you've known how difficult her heartache is. And yet, how many people are doing this to parents of special needs children, of children with emotional turbulence in their life? Children who are choosing to go into all types of things, whether it's addiction, whether it's gender issues, whether it's homosexuality, whether whatever. And yet we leap to them and say, you know, hey, if you ever get tired of your kid acting this way, you know, I got some. Really? I think we're called to have great humility in this area as believers and people who want to share the great redemption work of God. How can we say there is a redeemer to other people unless we first understand it ourselves and see that redemption in our own life? And that causes us to walk with great confidence, but with great humility into other people's heartache. The verse that is just heavy on my heart, and it has been since I've started doing this program, is what Paul said in Corinthians. You comfort one another with the same comfort that you yourself have received from the God of all comfort. Well, what comfort have I received through this now multi-decade journey I've had with Gracie? If you had to speculate, particularly those of you who listened to the program for a long time, what would you say? What kind of comfort do you think I've received from the God of all comfort? Well, I'll tell you, I have received the comfort of knowing that he who began a good work is faithful to complete it, as Paul says in Philippians. I have received the comfort of knowing that he has not abandoned us, that our God is sovereign, and he is not caught unawares of all that is going on with Gracie in the suffering that I observe every day. I have the comfort of knowing that he accepts me because of what he did, the provisions he made on the cross, that I can boldly go to him. And as Paul says, cry, Abba, Father, Daddy. I have the comfort of knowing that he's working all of these things to his glory for good. And I can trust him. I have the comfort of knowing that as I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil because he's with me. And all these promises in scriptures and all these things that he says about himself, I have been comforted knowing that I can rely on that, that it is bedrock, that there is that assurance. You remember when I told you I named that surgery of Gracie's in Denver earlier this year? I called it Operation Assurance, Aggressive Assurance, because all of us cry out for assurance. Is it going to be okay? Is it going to be okay? Is it going to be okay? And I have that comfort of knowing that, yeah, it's going to be okay. For a season, it's going to be hard. It's going to be painful. It's going to be lonely. It's going to be distressing, wearisome, frustrating, and even vexing at times. But it is going to be okay. And he's going to be with me through those times. So when we see others who are in peril, whatever the distress, even if it's self-inflicted, most things are. Do we go in heavy-handed? Do we go in with this growling, thus saith the Lord? Or do we go in weeping and sit with them and assure them? Are we willing to stand at the doorway like that pastor said, I can't come in until I ask your forgiveness? That's my hope for myself, that I will emulate that because I'm going to mess it up. What do I mean? I'm going to mess it up. I have messed it up. You have no idea. But yet that is our hope, that he is that great redeemer. There is a redeemer. And that is hope for the caregiver. This is Peter Rosenberger. We'll be right back. Correctional facility in Arizona that helps us recycle prosthetic limbs. And this facility is run by a group out of Nashville called Core Civic. And we met them over 11 years ago. And they stepped in to help us with this recycling program of taking prostheses and you disassemble them. You take the foot, the knee, the foot, the pylon, the tube clamps, the adapters, the screws, the liners, the prosthetic socks, all these things we can reuse, and inmates help us do it. Before CoreCivic came along, I was sitting on the floor at our house or out in the garage when we lived in Nashville, and I had tools everywhere, and I had limbs everywhere and feet, boxes of them and so forth. And I was doing all this myself, and I'd make the kids help me. And it got to be too much for me. And so I was very grateful that CoreCivic stepped up and said, look, we are always looking for faith-based programs that are interesting and that give inmates a sense of satisfaction. And we'd love to be a part of this. And that's what they're doing. And so I'm very grateful for that. And you can see more about that at standingwithhope.com/recycle. So please help us get the word out that we do recycle prosthetic limbs. We do arms as well, but the majority of amputations are lower limb. And that's where the focus of Standing with Hope is. And that's where Gracie's life is, with her lower limb prostheses. And she's used some of her own limbs in this outreach that she's recycled. I mean, she's been an amputee for over 30 years. So you go through a lot of legs and parts and other types of materials, and you can reuse prosthetic socks and liners if they're in good shape. All of this helps give the gift that keeps on walking, and it goes to this prison in Arizona where it's such an extraordinary ministry. Think about that. Inmates volunteering for this. They want to do it, and they've had amazing times with it, and I've had very moving conversation with the inmates that work in this program. And you can see, again, all of that at standingwithhope.com/recycle. They're putting together a big shipment right now for us to ship over. We do this pretty regularly throughout the year as the inventory rises, and they need it badly in Ghana. So please go out to stadiumwithhope.com/recycle and get the word out and help us do more. If you want to offset some of the shipping, you can always go to the giving page and be a part of what we're doing there. We're purchasing material in Ghana that they have to use that can't be recycled. We're shipping over stuff that can be, and we're doing all of this to lift others up and to point them to a Savior. And that's the whole point of all this, and that's why we are Standing with Hope. Thanks so much.
Do you see? Do you see all the people sinking down? Don't you care? Don't you care? Are you gonna let them drown?
Welcome back to Hope for the Caregiver. This is Peter Rosenberger. This is the program for you as a family caregiver. And we're glad that you are with us. There's a new film out called Unseen. It's a documentary. Guess what it's about? It's about a caregiving family. I have the creative minds behind this film here with me, Tom and Amanda Dyer from Nashville, Tennessee. This film is creating quite a buzz around the country. It is a subject that is near and dear, of course, to my heart, and I want to welcome you all to the program. So thanks for being here with us.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Tell me what piqued your interest on that. I mean, your background in film, what about this grabbed your interest?
Yeah, we actually had no connection to this world to begin with. We're not parents or caregivers ourselves. So we were actually just talking about kind of doing a creative project, something for fun that we wanted to collaborate on, that, you know, we could do together. And right about that time, we just stumbled across the Ronnie family through social media, realized they lived not too far from us. We, you know, they kind of mentioned that they thought a documentary would be a powerful tool to kind of show the challenges of being a caregiver and really peel back that curtain and give people a better glimpse. And that just piqued our interest. Once we met with them, they just told us some stories that really blew our minds. And we just saw immediately that there was some potential here for a documentary to be a powerful tool to tell their stories and really just open people's minds.
Yeah, it started off as a passion project for us. It was just, we do a lot of client work, and we wanted to do something that was more meaningful and just something that we could kind of sink our teeth into. And this was something that these families are going through that we had no knowledge of previously. And so once we started to kind of become aware of some of this stuff, it was pretty surprising to us and something we felt like we could help tell these experiences and these stories for these families.
What is their background? What is their story? Just in a brief overview.
Yeah, the really high level. They are a blended family. Both Jess and Ryan, their first spouses passed away. And so they were caregivers for their spouses first. And then when they found each other and got married, blended their families. So now they have 8 children, one of whom is Lucas, who has profound disabilities. And they've just gone through kind of a crazy journey of, first of all, not even thinking that he was going to survive. But then he was born. They had tons of support from their church, community, family, friends, and kind of took that for granted. And then as he got older, they ended up moving. We're a little more rural environment. Some of that help fell away, and everything changed. They just started, as he got older, things were more difficult. The help fell away, the resources fell away. And that's when they were just really struggling and looking around saying, what do we do? We don't have support and we don't know what to do.
What did you all, I mean, you went in this with no knowledge of this world of caregivers. What surprised you? What was your takeaway? What dismayed you? What broke your heart? All of the above.
Yeah. Short answer is quite a bit. I think that one of the surprising things was just the isolation that a lot of these families experience, just being as busy and as occupied as they are with just the things that are necessary for them to take care of their family or their individual that they're caring for. I mean, it's just, it's for a lot of them, it's constant and there's not much relief. And one thing we talk about a lot is respite, you know, the idea of respite in a lot of these families, it just, it doesn't exist. We got a lot of feedback from other caregivers during this, and just the similarities between the issues that they experience across the board were just always surprising, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we heard so many of the same or similar stories over and over, and we just had no idea that this was such a common issue. I mean, the stat that we found is there's 16.8 million people caring for, and that's just caring for a child with this. That doesn't even, you know, count elder care or spouse, you know, other kinds of caregiving. So with numbers like that, there's a good chance, you know, everybody knows a caregiver in some form or fashion. So it was just eye-opening to us to realize that there's caregivers all over, and it's just so easy to kind of not realize that, because a lot of caregiving happens at home, and because it can be difficult to get out into the community, it's not accessible, it's not built for families, that it's easy just to not see them and not think about them. And that, I mean, that's what this made us, and is what motivated this project too.
What are some things that surprised you in a positive way that you say, okay, this is life-changing for me, this is a principle I'm seeing going on here, whether it's faith-related, whether it's what is your takeaway that Tom and Amanda now are, your lives will never be the same because of this kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, so many things, truly. I think I always say, you can't care about something you don't know about. And then now that we know, we have to care. Like, we care. We are invested in this now. And I think it's something that we can't unknow now. So we feel very motivated to do what we can for this community, to use the skills that we have to bring this message to light. And we are totally grateful and indebted to the families that were willing to share with us, who, you know, they didn't know us, they didn't know what our angle was or what our motivation was, but they trusted us and told with their stories, gave us, you know, glimpses into their life behind the scenes, and shared things that are difficult and made them vulnerable. So we are truly grateful to them being willing to do that. And I think it also is encouraging to see that other people do care too. As we bring this to communities and hear from people that are watching it, we are seeing that people do care and want to know, what can I do after, you know, now that I'm aware, what can I do? How can I help? So I hope that's encouraging for the caregivers that are listening, to know that as people become aware, there is more compassion building.
How about you, Tom?
I mean, I think one of the things that surprised me quite a bit and was inspiring is just a lot of the families that we talk to and work with, they are so busy, and so they have so much to do, and yet they find the time and the capacity to advocate for other families as well. I mean, it's obviously such a tight-knit community that really has each other's backs. And it was fun to see these people, these families go, you know, kind of lock arm in arm, to help out each other in any way they can, especially when they have so much to do. Just some of the perseverance that a lot of them, that I saw in a lot of them, was, particularly inspiring. So, it was definitely eye-opening in a lot of ways.
Were there moments when you were behind the camera, you're looking at the playback, you're watching this thing unfold, or maybe just in the edit room, where you just kind of had to stop and take a knee, catch your breath a little bit? Did you have those kind of moments?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. We're very grateful to the Ronnie family just for being as open as they were. And that was something that we had to really balance, right? Is because so much of caregiving and so much of the struggle that these families go through happens behind closed doors. So people don't see it often. And the Ronnie family was kind enough to let us behind those closed doors and be vulnerable with us. And that at times was difficult. I mean, just to see what their daily life played out. And so how their daily life played out. And so it was tough at times just to watch, what they go through and just how meticulously they have had to manage and structure their days so that things run at least somewhat smoothly when they can. And so it was, there were times where it was quite surprising for sure.
But I think it's the hearing the stories from so many different families and getting the feedback of, you know, people who have seen it, or, you know, hearing how meaningful it is to them and how they've found it eye-opening or healing to watch, or that's sort of the fuel to keep, I mean, you know, it's a lot of effort to create and distribute a documentary, and we honestly didn't totally see all of that coming, but it's their responses and them telling us how important it is that is really that fuel to keep going, even when it is, you know, challenging subject matter and challenging just to manage.
Now, you guys are premiering this in various places. Tell me a little bit about the premieres that are going on. You have live events, you have satellite events, you've got online stuff. Tell me what's going on with that in the last minute.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're doing a lot of different ways of getting it out. We have some in-person screenings, the next one coming up locally here in Nashville on September 25th. And then we're also doing other in-person ones around the country. If you go to our website, caregiverdoc.com/watch, that's kind of the ongoing list of screenings that are popping up. So you can keep an eye on that. And then we're also doing a national premiere in November in along with National Family Caregivers Month. So that's coming up too. No matter where you are, you'll be able to access that one.
Excellent. What's next for you guys? I mean, this is obviously taking you by storm. I mean, this is a bigger project than you ever intended.
True.
What's next?
Well, we're working on some bonus content to kind of go along, dive into some of these issues a little bit more deeply. So if anyone's interested in sharing to contribute to that, there's some information on our website there as well. And then we do have some other projects in the works. They're still very early on in development stage, but we're hoping some of those can pan out and we can start telling more stories as well.
Are you going to do an extended version with the gag reel? No, I'm just kidding.
There's some bloopers lingering around.
we have lots of bloopers at my house. So that would be kind of fun. Well, yeah. This is very exciting, and I'm glad to see a concerted effort on this. I'm glad to hear about the reception that you're getting. Obviously, audiences around the country that are seeing this are being very moved by this, and it's resonating deeply. And it's an extraordinary project that you two have taken on, particularly since you had no connection to this. You just saw the need. And there are a lot of us caregivers out there. And mm-hmm. I would like to thank you for doing this. I think it's going to be an extraordinary film and project for you guys. This is Peter Roseberg with Tom and Amanda Dyer. The movie is called Unseen. Go to caregiverdoc.com, caregiverdoc.com. And Tom and Amanda, thank you so much for being here with me today.
Thank you so much for having us.
All right, we'll be right back.
I know there will be sorrow. We'll face that somehow. But my hands can't hold tomorrow. I can only hold you now.
Welcome back to Hope for the Caregiver. This is Peter Rosenberger, and we're so glad that you are with us. HopeForTheCaregiver.com. Some years ago, I met a wonderful lady named Suzanne White, and she was on my program when we were back in Nashville. It's been way too long, and she's got a new book out called Self-Care for Caregivers. Her website is Caregiver Warrior, and she is one. And I'm glad to have you back, Suzanne. It's been way too long, so thank you for being back, and I apologize for taking so long to get you on this program.
Oh, listen, anytime I can be with you, I will wait forever. So I am happy to be here.
Very gracious of you. Bring us up to speed on your journey first, then we'll get into this new book. For folks that don't know you, haven't met you before, tell us a little bit about your journey.
Yes, I will be glad to do that. Happy to do that. So, you know, I was a caregiver for my parents and other family members, and so often I would feel lost and alone and realize that they don't tell you anything. Like, they don't tell you about this stuff. So I was blessed to take care of mom and dad. And during that journey, since I didn't get along with mom too well, I had to make lots of changes in my life. And I figured, you know, let me just jot some of this stuff down, because I was a singer-songwriter. You know, I used to be a lyricist. So I knew that writing stuff down and journaling for me would really be helpful. So I kind of kept a log and little notes here and there. So as I finished, and I lost both of them within 7 weeks of each other. I just figured maybe some caregivers out there could benefit from some of the mistakes I made. So I started blogging, you know, and I came up with Caregiver Warrior, because I think the caregivers are warriors. I think they're out there fighting every day. And I started a blog and a website, and it seems to be helping people. So here I am, Caregiver Warrior, and trying to save one caregiver at a time.
Well, and you're not a timid person. You are a fighter, and you bring a great deal of passion to everything you do. Tell me about this book, Self-Care for Caregivers. Self-Care for Caregivers. It just came out. I mean, it's brand new.
Just brand new. And it's,
I don't even have my copy yet.
Which is a shame. You've got to make
I got to change that. I got you. So how about that? So, but tell us a little bit about this book.
Well, you know, I'm so excited because it's actually in my hands. You know, it's incredible when you have a creative process and it's in your head and then you put it in your hands. So I actually have it, the hard copy, in my hands. You know, I took notes, and I just thought, you know what, let me jot this down. And as I was doing stuff on Instagram and all my social media and everything, Adams Media, which is a division of Simon Schuster, came to me and said, hey, would you ever think about writing a book? And I went, funny, yeah, I would do. Yeah. They said, well, we'd like you to do something for us. So we jumped at it together, and they have been absolutely lovely. And I came up with Self-Care for Caregivers. It's 140 tools and tips and strategies that I came up with, and really an easy to read, jump in anywhere in the book guide for caregivers to help them prioritize themselves.
What does that look like for you? Give me an example. I mean, granted, I know kind of what it looks like for me, you know, but for you, what does that look like?
It looks like being self-aware. That was the big ticket that drove me home, was that I had to be self-aware. I had to be self-aware of what I was physically feeling, what I was emotionally feeling. You know, I had to really lock into what was going on with me on a daily basis. And I always say, you know, caregivers need to take their emotional temperature. I really had to do that because I tend to be a control freak and a perfectionist, and I push my own feelings down, and I wasn't as aware of my body and my mind as I should have been when I was caring for other people. Because I'd start to get snarky, you know, I'd start to get like emotional, I'd start to get angry, you know, short-tempered, frustrated, and exhausted. So, you know, for me, self-care really began when I looked in the mirror and said, you know what, you're really focused on them. You need to focus on you a little bit. Like, how are you feeling? You know how they're feeling. You know what their temperature is. You know what's going on with them. What's going on with you? And that's how I started the self-care process.
You've been doing this a while, talking to other caregivers and so forth, and getting out there fighting this battle. You know, what has surprised you about you through this journey? I mean, things about you that you just didn't even realize you had in you.
Wow, that's such a great question. And it has to come from another caregiver, because caregiving is a journey for everybody, for those we care for and for us. You know, everybody changes, I think. There's a lot of adaptation that you have to go through. But I think for me, caregiving, what really surprised me about me was that how I could function being completely exhausted. Like, I had no idea how resilient I was. I knew that I could get things done because that's my personality and I've done it in business. What I didn't understand about myself was how I was unstoppable. Like, I would stop for myself before I would stop for the people I loved. I mean, I think the energy is God-given, you know? I mean, the energy that we have as caregivers, and we have to be really careful because it can be dangerous because we can run on nothing in the gas tank. And I think, you know, it surprised me how I could keep going. And what surprised me was how damaged I could be from it.
You know, I get, and we push ourselves. I often say we push ourselves recklessly, hurl ourselves recklessly at something that cannot be changed. And we end up becoming brittle in the process. And, yes. You and I've had that conversation before. I want, when you get out there and you're starting to see people engage with this book, you know, what are you hoping that your readers are going to, because I think, let me set the table on this one. You and I have been doing this for a long time. There are things that we do that are very obvious to us, but they're not necessarily obvious to anybody else just because we've been doing it out of time. And the obvious becomes obvious right before it becomes obvious. And so one of the things that I try to remind myself is that what I'm doing every day, I just kind of get into this pattern. I'm doing it out of expediency and out of necessity. Other people may have no clue to how to incorporate this in their own life. Talk about that in your book and how that's going to affect people in their journey.
Yes. And yes, you and I really get it, you know, and I think that's the thing that so many caregivers, first of all, a lot of caregivers don't even realize they're caregivers. You know, I mean, if you're helping anybody out with anything, you're a caregiver. Second of all, you don't realize how isolating it is and how you isolate. I think that caregivers don't realize that, you know, they want to fix everybody and fix everything, and we can't. That's not what this is about. We can't control everything, you know, and I think you have to learn these things. I think that when you first go into caregiving, you think you're going to do it all, you're going to do it all perfectly, and you're going to do it all alone. And, you know, wrong. You know, that's not how it works. You know what I mean? You're going to get burnout. We're all going to get burnout. You know, and people say, oh, you know, avoid caregiver burnout. You can't. Every single caregiver I know gets burnout. But
hold on
a second.
That's one of those things I'm going to have to write down. Avoid caregiver burnout. You can't. I love that. I'm actually writing that one down.
You can't. It's impossible. We, with the blessing and the goodness of our hearts, we're trying to do something that is devastating for all involved. You cannot avoid caregiver burnout. My whole thing is, do you want to hit the wall with caregiver burnout at 10 miles an hour or 150 miles an hour? That's the thing we can control. In other words, if you're aware of yourself and you focus on you and you try to prioritize things that make you feel better in your life, when you do hit that wall of caregiver burnout, it's not going to be so devastating, and it's not going to take you a week to get back to your better self. You know, I think that's the thing that's so important, is that we have to think of ourselves as athletes. We have to be in the best form we can be, body, mind, spirit.
In the world of professional athletes, I'm a bowler.
There you go.
I'm a bowler. Well, I love that. Just out of curiosity, what speed did you hit the wall at?
Well, the first time I hit the wall, I hit it 150 miles per hour. And that's the message I want. The other message too is that there is no perfect caregiver, and there's no perfect way to do it. And there's not a book. You can buy a book that can give you suggestions and guide you, but there's no rule book. Everyone is doing the best they can. So I hit it. I went into it thinking that I had all the answers and I was going to do it, and I understood everything. And I hit the wall. And thank God I knew other caregivers, and I called them. That was the first thing I learned.
How hard was that phone call? That first phone call?
You know, surprisingly easy, because, Peter, I was so bad. I was physically and emotionally so freaked out. I was shaking. I had the shakes. I was literally like shaking. I was in a state of terror. I thought something, I can't tell you how upset and frightened I was physically and spiritually and emotionally. So scared that I, thank God, I picked the phone up.
Well, and I'm glad you did. And I'm glad of the journey that you've been on since that phone call, and you're helping a lot of people, including me. And I'm just very grateful to have you as a part of this. And the book is called Self-Care for Caregivers, Suzanne White, caregiverwarrior.com. She's a great friend of the show, great friend of mine. And we're going to have you back on soon. Okay.
All right, my love. Thank you so much. And remember, you're just brilliant the way you are right now.
Very much. This is Peter Rosenberger. This is Hope for the Caregiver. We'll see you next time.